This honorable court is again in session. Be seated, please. Case number 08-3013, United States of America versus Jerome Joseph, also known as James Pierre, appellant. Ms. Dyer for appellant, Ms. Miller for appellee.
Good morning, Your Afternoon, and good morning, Your Honor. And I just said good morning, and may it please the court, Beverly Dyer on behalf of Jerome Joseph.
Start, Ms. Dyer. I'm going to ask the government as well. We didn't get as much help as we expected on the question of whether to close the courtroom or not. And so I guess our first question is, do you think that there are, that your motion said that we couldn't discuss things without discussing things that are under seal, right? My question is, do you think that the things that are under seal should be unsealed so that we can discuss them? Or do you think that they raise issues that should not be discussed in open court?
No, it is our position that the things that are under seal should remain under seal, and that there still remains a risk to my client of revealing his cooperation in particular.
Keep in mind, we're in open court now. Yeah. Well, let me ask the government then. Is your the government, if you would come up. The government's motion seemed to be based on nothing other than the fact that the government likes open courtrooms, which, by the way, doesn't appear to be the consistent view of the government. Do you think that there is a risk to the defendant's client here, or do you think that there is no risk?
I think I would defer to the defendant's counsel about the risk that he may face given the information that would be disclosed today.
You don't have any grounds for arguing that there's no risk. Is that what you're saying?
I don't have any grounds for arguing that there's no risk, correct.
Yeah, and I guess, like those questions, it's really for both counsel. Is there any reason why there cannot be a productive oral argument that simply that assumes that there are differences with respect to 5K11 between the defendant and co-defendants, and then proceeds to analyze the issues with that as a given?
That would not reveal matters under seal? Is that
right? In other words, just take it as given that there are differences with respect between the defendant here and the other defendants with respect to 5K11, but we don't go into any detail as to what those differences are. Is there not much that can be argued about productively?
Are we assuming that the differences our work in our client's favor?
They favor your client enormously.
In other words, can we do this in a hypothetical basis and therefore discuss a law question? We have all the facts in the briefing material.
I have not prepared argument that way, but I think it could be done, yes.
Okay, well, maybe we should start that way at least. And if we come to the end of that time, the government wants to say something?
May I?
Yes.
As you're aware, the 5K motions are not under seal.
Oh, I guess I'm not aware of that. What, the facts of the 5K motions are not under seal? The 5K motion themselves, your motion, the government's motion, was not under seal.
The only things under seal are the sentencing transcript and the plea hearing transcript.
If that's right, why is it that my copy of the government's brief is almost completely blank? That is the public version.
The public version is completely blank. Yes, because
right, it is right. Because I wasn't imagining that.
No, not at all, Your Honor. Yeah. It is a sentencing issue that is on appeal, and the sentencing transcript is under seal. So it is difficult to discuss what happened at sentencing without revealing what was said at sentencing. The sentencing transcript is under seal, but the 5K motions.
Well, so it certainly seems okay, I take it, then, to discuss what's in. Let me ask Ms. Dwyer again. Is there any problem with discussing what's in the 5K1 motion?
Not what's in the government's brief, but our position on the state of the district court record is that, and I understand there could be some dispute as to this position is that when matters are both under seal and they have been revealed publicly, that we would prefer that they not be discussed. There are a number of matters that were revealed in public in the district court record, and that includes both the government's 5K motions and the defendant's sentencing motion, as well as all of the materials for the co-defendant and for the third participant. So
those
the only things
revealed, those were revealed in public.
Those were revealed in public. Therefore, but for some details that were revealed at the plea transcript and the sentencing transcript, primarily the plea transcript hearing, most of the materials that are under seal overlap with materials that are not under seal. And that has been quite honestly, I have never encountered this type of situation in a case in my experience. And no one in our office has encountered it, so I've grappled with
the reason we're asking this is, needless to say, in the end, we're going to want to write an opinion, and given the nature of the public briefs, it looked like an opinion that would be all blank, and we'd rather not, as you can imagine, rather not do that. So I think the best thing would be to let you start. We're going to assume that the kind of argument you make here is something we can put into an opinion as well. With respect to the description of your argument and the description of the answers. Is that... just be careful to not reveal what you think are fact issues that...
would identify this case.
That's right. And we will, if we come to the end of this time, if you have more that you want to say in a closed hearing, we'll close the courtroom for a short closed hearing on the additional fact issues you want to raise.
The difficulty is that my client's name is on this case, and therefore any decision that this court writes will be identifiable to his associates. Right. Any finding that this court makes with respect to his cooperation, distinguishing him from his associates, will be revealed in that case if it's part of the court's ruling, which has been one of the difficulties of presenting argument here when there are both sealed and unsealed materials, and we are quite concerned about revealing the extent of his cooperation. At least my client has expressed
even the that. Even the comparative degree, that is, as Judge Williams put it, an assumption about the comparative degree that is compared to each of the other two? I would say normally we deal with this by having the name of the case be In Re Seal Case, but you did not move to do that for some.
I did move to do that in the district court. It was denied. That motion was denied in the district court, and we left it at that. I also considered moving to proceed under a pseudonym, and having not done that in the district court, I did not believe it would be well received in this court. And so we elected to proceed with sealed briefs and to do our best to protect my client's information. I can proceed with argument and on the theory that it is unlikely that something in this argument will be revealed in public or will wind up in public, but I am concerned about the court's publicly filed
brief. I don't think you can't assume that, so you better be careful.
Well, that's why I moved to close the courtroom.
Yeah.
And I am a little bit, my hesitation stems from my own ability to argue and to parse out the parts of the case that concern my client about his cooperation.
All right, well, why don't you do the best that you can, thinking of this as a series of law questions,
yes.
And even if you want to phrase them as hypotheticals, and then afterwards we'll let you have a chance for a closed discussion of this particular
sounds
fact.
Like the court does not need my opening argument, which had to do with the district court's finding, which is on page 40 of the sealed sentencing transcript. Mm-hmm. I think that finding is flatly in conflict with the district court's ruling on the motions themselves and the extent of the departure for the various participants. There are a number of interesting legal issues that I think are presented in this case. And I would argue that the district court's abuse of discretion is both procedural and substantive. The abuse of discretion that's procedural stems from both failing to address my client's arguments.
Pause, just for 1 second. That finding would be subject to plain error because there was no objection.
No. I believe it was objected to. I think when the defense counsel argued that my client's assistance was as significant and as useful, complete, reliable, and extensive as the co-defendants, if not more so. There's no way to interpret that argument but for a request for a departure.
I'm sorry. I thought when you meant the finding, I thought you were referring, there's a particular factual finding about your client's presence at a certain event. And that's not what you're talking about.
No. Okay. I was talking about a particular factual finding about my client being instrumental
we understand. Okay.
Both the co-defendant and the third participant plead guilty. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a particularly significant finding. And there are a number of other ways in which...
Doesn't that take us straight, as the government brief tried to, in response, to Townsend and the sentencing package doctrine?
No, because typically when this court is reviewing substantive claims, and this is moving into the substantive area of the total sentencing package and the totality of the circumstances, typically a party comes in and argues we have a reason that the district court failed to consider, didn't consider enough, didn't give enough weight to, or an improper reason that was considered. But there's no way to assess how that reason affected the sentence in terms of evaluation. Here we have a component of the sentence, which is the substantial assistance departures, which we know what its value was, and we know that it affected the sentence. And therefore, here you have to look at the components of the sentence with respect to whether they were rational, and here it was not rational. There was no rational
Doesn't
basis.
The sentencing package doctrine make step-by-step review of the sentencing procedure, I won't say impossible, but certainly very different from the sort of thing that goes on in ordinary step-by-step review of an agency's proceeding or court's reasoning.
Let me move to what I think is the crux of the district court's procedural error and abuse of discretion. The district court just didn't do it right. The court made a ruling on substantial assistance that we don't know what the grounds for are and that was not rationally based, and then went on to impose a sentence, possibly taking into account some other things that maybe the court could have taken into account, but because we have no explanation of the court's reasons for either the departure or the final sentence.
We have an explanation for the reason. We don't have an explanation for the number of levels. Is that what you're saying?
We know why the departure was granted. We don't know why the departure was less than that of the other, than the co-defendant and the participants, and why the extent of it was not as great or greater than the other, the co-defendant and the other participant.
Well, I guess the question is, why isn't the overall result obvious? That is, in light of what the court said about relevant culpability, and in light of the fact that the sentences for all three come out arrayed exactly as the court described and as the government described relative culpability, why isn't that obvious?
Because even if the court was allowed to do that in the end and could have had reasons, we don't know that that's what the court would have done had the court not made the irrational decision on substantial assistance departure on the 5K motions.
It's supposed to give substantial weight to the government's evaluation of the substantial assistance, according to the commentary, right?
And the government...
And it did what the government requested.
The government at the three sentencing hearings, and here I don't want to refer to the hearings, but I don't think that this is particularly revealing, argued that the weight was appropriate, that the level was appropriate, that the extent of the departure was appropriate because of the defendant's role in the offense. Well, they cite the organizer, the co-defendant, who... role in the offense, who was the organizer and a gang leader, as significantly more serious than my client's role in the offense, and yet he received a larger substantial departure.
But overall, but with respect to the actual number of months, he didn't, and with respect to the overall package, given the 924C problem, he still ended up above.
Well, let me say it this way. If the district court had said, and this appears to be what the government may have done, we think you actually deserve, to my client, if we think you actually deserve 5 levels off for substantial assistance, but because of the favorable plea deal that you got, we're only going to give you 3. If the district court had done that, that would be wrong. That would be procedurally wrong. That's not the way the court could have.
That's why that would be. So we have this opinion in Ray Seal case, which.
Perhaps this one.
Very unusual title, yeah. Which is the one that was decided in May 23rd, 2000.
449, that's a third, right, yes.
Right. Which, so it goes to this question of whether you can consider things other than cooperation, not in deciding whether to yes. do a 5K, yes. but in to do how much.
Yes.
And it seems, this is, I'm talking about this as a procedural, not a substantive
yes,
issue.
Yes, exactly. And in that case, the government made arguments that were favored a higher sentence at the sentencing hearing explicitly. Mm-hmm. So those arguments were out in the open.
That's a different
point. The district court relied on.
No, but that's a different.
That's not what happened here.
I know, but I'm trying to separate the two points out. Your first point was that it's improper, I thought, and you do say this in the brief, that it's improper to consider non-cooperation factors in deciding how many levels to go down. Or maybe I misread you.
No, I think the way it should have been done is to decide, based purely on substantial assistance factors, what the level of the assistance reduction should have been, and then go on to adjust in the, whether it's the second step or the third step, the Booker analysis, the 3553A analysis. If then there's some compensation owed for the plea deal, despite the gun bump at that point, then maybe, or for the role in the offense,
all right, so
then it's proper and correct for the district court to do that. And the district court could have, I'm sorry.
That's all right. So imagine we're in pre-Booker land, mm-hmm. okay, which we are for the first part of this analysis, which is to determine whether, with respect to where the guidelines should go, including in guidelines, departures from the guidelines, that is, guidelines authorized departures, was appropriate. And imagine that was the end of it. So the first question is, pre-Booker, could the court not have said, well, your cooperation actually was really good and maybe deserving in some way of 4 levels or 10 levels, but you are really, this is all hypothetical, you are a really bad person and I'm only going to go down to 3. The court could certainly have done that. Notwithstanding that they're using 5K, that is, how many levels down they go could be determined, how many levels down the district court went could be determined based on taking into consideration culpability as well. That's what
and
seems
that's,
like.
That's what In Re Seal case held with a one-way ratchet.
Yes. So the court could do that. So that's not a procedural violation to take that into consideration.
But I think that the court needs to be explicit about what it's doing, and that's the procedural. That's
right,
part
so
of
now
the procedural
it's
violation.
The explanation is what you're saying.
It's doing it in the right order with the right considerations, so that it can be the public perception of it is fair, and so that this court can review it. And there, the reasons go with the way the court sort of procedurally mixed up the steps. Or may have, we don't know, because we don't have any reason for this distinction in the substantial assistance levels. So
that's plain error, though, right? That precise issue?
No, because we asked for 7 levels. We asked for a substantial assistance.
I get it as the substance of the degree of departure, but as the failure to explain. Doesn't someone need to tell the district court at some point, we don't think you've sufficiently explained this?
I did acknowledge in our opening brief that we did not ask for a specific explanation of why the substantial assistance departure was less. However, in retrospect and looking at some of the decisions, I think that there are certainly some instances in which when an argument is made and the court is then required to respond to it, as in Rita, the Supreme Court's terms in Rita's, any non-frivolous reason for a lower sentence should be addressed by the district court, and here was not. That then the court, having made an argument and requested something, that the defendant does not need to then say when the argument is rejected, please tell me your reasons.
But could I just go back? Your argument with respect to the number of levels was not, was it? Couched in comparative terms?
No, but the request...
If that's the case, I'm not sure why the judge was required to answer it in comparative terms.
The argument that his cooperation was as great or greater than the co-defendant's was couched in comparative terms, and there's no way to interpret that argument but a request for a departure at least as large or larger than the co-defendant's. And I think that preserved that argument. The defendant also explicitly cited subsection A6, and he argued that he assisted with respect to the co-defendant. He argued that he should receive a sentence substantially lower than the co-defendant's. So I think that all of those arguments taken together can only be interpreted, particularly the one...
That last one, that was certainly taken into consideration. That's a combined argument.
That's a totality or, right. or a complete sentence package
right.
Argument. But I think the others did go specifically to the arguments that we make. And I think with respect to a statement of reasons, I think the district court is required to address, without another request, that it state its reasons for it, non-frivolous arguments, and that's held in Rita and in Gall, and the purpose of it is to promote public perception of fairness and to enable review and to have a
the court did. I mean, there's a pretty extensive description of reasons. The real issue is here: how many sub-reasons, you know,
yes.
right? You have to analyze. And are there any cases either under the guidelines or after the guidelines, where the question of the court had to, you know, was told you departed 3 levels, you should have departed 4, or you departed 3 levels, you should have departed 2, where a court of appeals said the explanation wasn't sufficient with respect to how many levels of departure. And that was something that pre-guidelines we basically said was totally up to the court. Pre-Booker, mm-hmm. we basically said we're really not going to review this. This is a discretionary for the district court. Isn't that is right, right?
Yes, and I think, I think there was some review of the extent of departures. I think that it has become much more significant in the Booker era. I don't have a specific case that I can cite to you.
Weren't those were mostly where the objector, whoever was objecting the departure was too far. So where the government was objecting that it was too low, or the defendant was objecting you are departing above too much. Mm-hmm. Here, what you're really saying is you like the direction of the departure. You want to even more. And I looked for a case like that. I couldn't find. I'm not saying there isn't one.
Mm-hmm. I don't have a citation of mm-hmm. one, but I do think that.
Why did you say it was more? I didn't mean to interrupt. If you had a point,
no, go ahead.
Why did you say it was more significant in the post-Booker era, the departure? I think they're much less. Some circuits have said they're irrelevant.
Well, that goes to whether the departure is part of the guidelines, part of the first step or the second step in the procedural process, and maybe there are 3 steps. There is A4, A5, and A6, mm-hmm. and so theoretically there could easily be 3 steps. And then the question is, is it entitled to a presumption of reasonableness for substantive review and a number of other questions?
I was just challenging the point, I think, picking off what Judge Garland said. He said, before Booker, we were very deferential, and I think you were trying to imply, well, it's more important now, so you should be less deferential, but I think your premise might be off there, because I think it's far less important now, actually, or at least not more important.
In terms of the departure distinguished from a variance, is that?
Right. Mm-hmm. If the departure is 3 instead of 6, the variance gives the district judge basically free rein to go from a very low sentence to a very high sentence, so long as it's sufficiently explained.
Well, I think what this court has to ask is it possible that the district court, had it explicitly addressed the reasons for the substantial assistance departure, would have imposed a different total sentence
right.
on the defendant? And I think here, because there are no reasons, and because it's unclear why the district court did this, and because it's irrational, it's flatly inconsistent with the findings.
But if we think that the court had the authority to take into consideration non-cooperation in making the amounts of the, it's not a possibility that the court, as a substantive law, did something wrong. what reason do we have to think that the court didn't know what the court was doing? That is, the court had from the government in each of these cases a description of the degrees of cooperation and the degrees of culpability. Assume for the moment that we're not going to disturb that because that's a district court judgment. And it came out in just exactly the way in which it was presented by the government. Why should we think that the court didn't know, you know, the differences in these disparities that you're talking about?
Because we have to look at the components of what went into that, and one of the components was flatly inconsistent with the record.
Inconsistent only if, on the theory that the court first did the departure levels and then considered culpability, but not inconsistent if the court put them together. Which in Ray Seal case we said the court could.
But how does this court know that's what was done when the grant was the exact number that was not consistent with a substantial assistance facts?
Because it was consistent with a way to get a package down to the level that the court thought was appropriate.
After Booker, I think that methodology is not. It's not honest. It doesn't demonstrate to the public a sort of a fair review of the record. Now, what the government did was apparently or possibly hide its attempt to sort of to compensate for the plea deal into its substantial assistance motions. And it says at one point in the co-defendant's substantial assistance motion that it's the purpose of requesting four levels is to make things equitable in terms of the sentences that the other defendants are going to receive. And so I think...
So that was in front of the court then?
It was in front of the court. The government made that request or made that representation that they should be measured against each other. But it's my position that the district court is required to analyze now, after Booker, to analyze the substantial assistance departure using those reasons relating to substantial assistance in the context of the total case,
even if they weren't required to do that, if the district court wasn't required to do that before, it is when the...
Yes.
So I thought the idea here is that, roughly, first thing the court has to do is figure out what it would have done pre-Booker, that is, what the guidelines and its various departure components permitted, and then apply its discretion. But that first part, which is really what you're talking about, is not affected by Booker, except that Booker includes that as a procedural issue. Am I wrong about that?
I think that the second part, the departure part, that the court could do before and after Booker, when it considered the defendant's the nature of the offense and the extent to which the departure, the assistance, the cooperation warranted a downward departure, the court could take into account culpability there under 5K. But I don't think it could make the kind of adjustment that that was analyzed in Ray Seal case in Stockdall, where the government acknowledged that it was attempting to achieve a sentencing end by requesting 5K departures for some counts and not for other counts. And I think it's the Eighth Circuit rejected that.
What's the name of that one?
Stockdall.
Stockdall.
And it's cited in Ray Seal case along with Thompson, which was a little different. But I think that's the type of circumstances of what happened here and was distinguished in Ray Seal case. But I think there all the government's arguments were out in the open in the sentencing hearing, and here they were not. And we don't have the government's explicit arguments, and we don't have the court's explicit reasons. So I would not have confidence in knowing that the court would not have issued a lower total sentence by some degree had the substantial assistance analysis been present, been honest, been explicit. And that's the crux.
Well, especially since some district judges still strictly follow the guidelines and some don't, right? So because they don't have to. But a judge who still says, I'm going to be a guidelines-centric judge, it'll matter even more what the departure is.
That's right? Correct, in terms of rubber stamping the government's requests, for one. If the court has no further questions, I will.
We'll give you time for rebuttal. Do you hear from the government?
May it please the court, Angela Miller for the United States. I'll wait for Judge Williams. May it please the court, Angela Miller for the United States. This court should affirm the district court sentence because it is both procedurally sound and substantively reasonable. I want to start first with the standard of review. Standard review here is under plain error because the district court was never asked to explain on the record why the departure she granted this defendant was different or how it related to the departure granted to a co-defendant or to the co-participant, nor is the district court required to. So certainly the appellant...
The defendant's position is that the defendant didn't know there was a difference. So it was a little hard to, I mean, they can make the general argument about where they should be, but the more specific contention that the array was wrong is impossible for them to make because they were not jointly sentenced.
They were not jointly sentenced, but the government filed all of the 5K motions at the same time. So the government's recommendation was certainly available because they were not sealed. But also the appellant's counsel.
This part I had not focused on before. I know you said that a moment ago. So your position is that the defendant would have known about the government's recommendations in all three cases because they were all filed publicly before this sentencing?
That's correct.
Including the last one was filed before?
Yes, correct. And they were all sentenced within a day of each other. The co-defendant was sentenced that morning, then appellant, and then the next morning the co-participant. But I think asking a district court to use its discretion to grant a greater departure under 5K than that recommended by the government is qualitatively different from informing a district court that it would be legal error to fail to put on the record why the grant that she did give was greater or lesser than another defendant being sentenced at another time.
That one, they didn't know, right? They didn't know because the sentencing itself was sealed.
Nothing was sealed at the time.
So the first sentencing hearing was in the was public as well?
That is correct. And it took place that morning.
And was this defendant advised of when that was? That is, was defense counsel advised of when that was?
I don't know if defense counsel for this defendant was advised.
Yes.
I do not know that, but they were sentenced the same day, and the co-participant was sentenced the next morning. But again,
the government would know that automatically, whereas the successive defendants would not necessarily know it automatically.
That is correct, but still the appellant here never requested in his sentencing memo or at sentencing itself to have a departure based on 5K that was equal to or greater than any of the other participants. The basis for asking for a greater departure under 5K was simply the 5K factors themselves, his assessment that the 5K factors warranted a greater departure. When he was at...
Did the government in any stage allude to, and how in any way, the sentencing package concept? Did it in any way alert defense counsel to the proposition that the 5K departure could be aimed at that?
Well, at this sentencing hearing, at appellant's sentencing hearing, the defense counsel referenced the recommendation that the government had made with respect to the co-defendant who was sentenced that morning. Does that answer
right.
your question? And in the 5K motion submitted by the government on behalf of the co-defendant,
yes.
the government made reference to the total sentencing package. Is that what you're asking?
In the context of the 5K departure.
The government stated in its 5K departure for the co-defendant.
Dorvilliers.
Yeah. Yes. That it was requesting a departure of a certain level.
Right.
In order to reflect the full extent of his cooperation. And to ensure, or not to ensure, but so that the sentences would be equitable. His sentence would be equitable with that of the other participants.
That's the reference Ms. Right. Weyer made before.
Correct. That was the government's recommendation.
Right.
However,
right.
as you know, a district court is not at all bound by the government's recommendation. It certainly has to give it substantial weight. And I think it's clear from the sentencing transcript here that the district court was well aware of her discretion to grant a greater departure certainly because she entertained all the arguments for it. And what we don't have is the district court simply rubber stamping the government's recommendation. She went through all of the 5K factors. I think it's obvious she gave substantial weight to the government's evaluation of the extent of the appellant's cooperation. But then she also put on the record the need that she had to consider other bases for departure, specifically the 3553A factors, and granted additional departures, and said on the record that she needed to come up with a sentence that was sufficient but not greater than necessary to meet the objectives of 3553. So I don't think you're having a district court act outside its discretion when it is putting on the record all the reasons for granting the departure. But her analysis didn't stop there. Again, she entertained other bases for departure as the defense counsel recommended or requested. But back to the standard of review just for a minute, when you don't have anybody informing a court that failing to give an explanation of one defendant's 5K departure as it relates to another defendant, that can't be telling the court, putting the court on notice that it's a legal objection being made. Certainly they requested a greater departure. That was clear from their sentencing memo. It was clear from
their... It wouldn't be plain error to the extent we're substantively reviewing the extent of the departure, but it would be plain error as to the failure to explain the basis for doing only three levels.
As it compares to another defendant,
right.
Correct.
Right.
But I think you can do a review of the district court's reasonings for granting a three-level departure. She put it on the record. She went through all of the 5K factors. She talked about the government's recommendation. She also acknowledged the defense counsel's request for a greater departure based upon 5K and based upon the 3553.
If defense counsel makes an argument that factor X should be seriously considered, and nothing in what the district court says visibly reflects any consideration of factor X, it's necessary in order to preserve the procedural complaint that defense counsel pop up and say, but Your Honor, you didn't say anything about factor X?
If I'm clear of what factor X is,
I use factor X because that saves.
That is your position. It's just a yes, isn't it, to Judge Williams' question? I think that's your position.
If my understanding of that there was some other basis for the district court to have granted a greater departure, are we on the same page?
My question is really much broader. Really much broader. Let's say we're at the final thing, the package, and the defense counsel identifies a particular factor, says it's really important, and it justifies, far greater leniency for my client. And the court throws the book at him and says not a word about whatever this factor is. I'm trying to make the question general. There's no procedural violation because the defense counsel didn't pop up and say you didn't mention factor X.
I think that's different than what happened here, which was we're requesting a greater departure.
We ask hypotheticals to get the scope of the...
No, I do understand. I think if it's clear from the... I think if it's clear from the record that defense counsel is somehow notifying the court that failing to do something would result in a legal error, would not just be an act of their discretion, but would result in legal error, then I think that would preserve an objection. But I don't think that's what happened here. Informing the court that they would prefer a greater departure than that recommended by the government because their interpretation of the 5K factors warrant a greater departure is simply asking the court to use its discretion. Again, different from informing the court that failing to do X, Y, or Z is a procedural error, results in a legal error. Does that answer your question?
I guess so. I think so.
Okay.
can we turn to substantive reasonableness?
Absolutely.
And you have an argument heading, the district court did not create a disparity between appellant's and his co-defendant's sentences that prejudiced appellant because appellant's sentence is less than his co-defendant's. Do you really understand that to be the law? That there's that imposition of the same or slightly lesser sentence on a particular person has no disparity problem, even though, let's assume, the substantive disparity is enormous, far greater than the disparity in the sentence.
I think under, we're talking about substantive
reasons. And I'm talking about the line in Gall, which refers to this, which commends the court for taking into account the problem of making suitable distinctions between defendants who are differently placed, as opposed to imposing the same sentence on them.
Right. I think our point in our brief is that the appellant was arguing that the district court created a disparity or failed to consider the need to avoid unwarranted disparities. And if you look at what the district court did here, which imposed a final sentence, which results in a sentence less for this appellant than his co-defendant, who played a greater role, not a significantly greater role, but a greater role in the offense than this appellant.
That's the substance of the disparity. The way this is worded, and you repeat the theory later in the brief, the proposition appears to be, as long as the, let's say, just less culpable defendant is sentenced ever so slightly below the more culpable defendant, there cannot be a disparity issue. Let's suppose that all wise men in the world call to judge the matter would find defendant A.
There's only 40?
No, I've made it all now. That defendant A was 100th as culpable as defendant B. You say that under 355A6, it would be fine to give them the same sentence. That appears to be the premise of this argument, and as I say, you repeat it in the substance of the brief.
If the defendants are similarly situated?
No.
I'm sorry, I'm trying to understand you.
They're not similarly situated. They get the same sentence.
One is much less guilty.
Well,
they're given the same sentence. On the wording of your argument here and in the substance of the brief, no problem.
I think what we probably meant to convey to this court was that in this case, there is no problem. And what you are not supposed to do is elevate any one of the 3553 factors over another. So if you had a hypothetical where there were defendants who were dissimilarly situated, they were not similarly
right.
situated, but they ended up receiving the same sentence, that could be based on any of the other 3553 factors that was taken into consideration by the court. Again, you can't elevate one over the other. In this case, however,
it's a strange hypo because they're really similarly situated.
You're saying these defendants are
similar? No, in your hypothetical. If they're really similarly situated, they ought to get the same sentence, right? So
that was the purpose of the guidelines, which the Supreme Court says no longer bind us, so or bind district courts. So if that was the goal, we're at the anti-goal. Each district court can do whatever the district court might have a different sentencing philosophy, right?
Right.
Well, on A6, is it really about the co-defendants anyway, or is it about all defendants who do similar crimes throughout the country?
Thank you. 3553A6 is actually focused on avoiding national unwarranted disparities. It's certainly appropriate.
What in the language excludes co-defendants who are right before the judge at the time?
I don't think anything in the language excludes a district court from considering that. It's whether the district court would be required to.
But the factors are mandated, right?
Imagine that as a hypothetical. Imagine they are the same in every way except one of them planned the operation, tortured the victim, took all the victim's money, killed all the victim's children, and the other one was the getaway driver. And the district court gave the getaway driver 1,000 years and the really bad guy probation. Would that be unreasonable?
I think you may have a good argument that it is substantively unreasonable.
That's what we're only talking about substantive
unreasonableness. That's the question of whether the 355A6 applies as a mandate, which is the way it's worded, to this sort of disparity.
I think you would have to take that into consideration when considering substantive reasonableness. But I also would inform this court that, as you know, you've explained that it would be the rare case that you would overturn a district court's decision on substantive reasonableness if it was within the guidelines or even above.
I understand.
What if they were sentenced by two different district judges? Do they have to have the same sentencing philosophies?
I think that's the result of having different district judges sentence and the guidelines no longer
you're
being
You're
getting
wildly disparate sentences, aren't you?
I'm sorry?
Yeah, I'm sure you think the lower sentence in Judge Williams' hypo is the substantively unreasonable one, not the higher sentence. But you're going to get a lot of disparate sentences now, right? Isn't that the whole...
Absolutely.
I mean, that was the... That's a good, people thought.
That is going to be a result of the guidelines no longer being mandatory. The judges get to use their discretion, and they get to apply, or excuse me, impose a sentence that they determine to be.
It isn't yet the case that all the 3553A factors have been thrown away.
No, absolutely not. I think that's part of what a district court has to do in sentencing is consider the factors. That's still part of the procedural reasonableness as well. And I think it's clear from this record that the district court considered all of the 3553 factors. She did talk about the different roles in the offense that the appellant and his co-defendant played. She explained the need to consider whether additional departures were warranted under 3553. And then she ultimately imposed a sentence that she felt was sufficient but not greater than necessary to meet the objectives of 3553. And I'll point out that that sentence was within the guidelines associated with the offense, reduced by acceptance of responsibility, reduced by the 5K motion, and then fell within a certain range, reduced again for his status as a deportable alien and the time he spent in the Haitian prison. So when you have a sentence like that where the district court actually puts on the record, does the math, shows her work about why she's granting the 5K motion, her knowledge that she has authority to grant additional departures and does so and winds up with a sentence that we would submit would be within the guidelines, it would be the very unusual case that this court would find that to have been abuse of discretion as substantively unreasonable. And well beyond my time if there are any more questions.
Thank you very much. We'll hear from Ms. Dyer. Why don't you take a couple minutes and then tell us at the end, we'll hear from Ms. Dyer. Tell us at the end whether you want to proceed at all in closed hearing.
I have a couple of points, and I do not think we need to proceed to continue in a closed hearing. I think here, just to go to what the government is saying, and I think what the crux of the case is, the facts, the reason why the total sentencing package cannot be the answer is the facts directly conflict with a component of the sentence that had a specific value and a specific effect on the sentence.
I mean, if I understood government counsel, she was saying that in its formulation of the request for the departure for Dorvilliers, it explicitly referred not only to the degree of cooperation, but to equity between the array of defendants. So is
that
it a fair inference that that was what was in the judge's mind?
Well, that suggests that that's what the government was requesting. That suggests that the district court was required to compare the three defendants under, whether it's under A6 or just in general.
It doesn't require that the judge spell out, particularly in the sentencing of A, exactly the details of the relation to B.
Well, doesn't it require that the rationale be consistent with the facts and not in direct conflict with the factual support for the assistance for the substantial assistance departures?
Only direct conflict if you disregard the sentencing package proposition.
But there is a component with a specific value and a specific effect on the sentence. With respect to national disparities, I just wanted to respond briefly to that. I've spoken with a representative of the federal defenders with statistical knowledge and knowledge of sentencing who says basically there are no national statistics that are specific enough to use in this context. I have never seen a sentencing hearing.
I thought the commission just reported to Congress that disparities have increased significantly since Booker. And the Department of Justice wrote a letter to Congress saying that they're very concerned about that. So I agree we can pick apart the statistics, but there's at least some basis for thinking disparities are increasing significantly, which
yes.
is hardly a shock. It was the inevitable
yes,
result.
I agree with that. But with respect to the district court, faced with making a decision in a specific case with individual facts and an individual offender, and specific conduct in the case, what the district court is supposed to compare that case to in applying A6. It cannot be the case that the district court is not allowed to apply A6 or is not supposed to apply A6 in the absence of national statistics, because the statistics are not, that are analyzed.
Right. I agree with you. It's impossible to do a full empirical survey every time you sentence someone of, right? That's your point. And that's why I think A6 is really about the guidelines as the magnet. You know, think about how much you're departing from the guidelines, because the guidelines were designed to be the heartland, right? And so you're avoiding disparities if you're...
Wouldn't it be duplicative? I mean, isn't it in the language of it? The plain language of it doesn't...
It wouldn't be the first time, but yes, it may be somewhat duplicative, but the point being, usually the guidelines would be the way you avoid unwarranted disparities. Then maybe child pornography or something, you realize that district judges around the country aren't following the guideline, and then you would say, actually, I need to sentence below the guidelines here to avoid unwarranted disparities, all of which, by the way, I'll just say is art, not science right now, because no one really knows what's going on in any other courtroom.
I think that's
so that's enough. I'll just leave it there, but you got my views on that national disparity issue. I think it's just very hard to get it exactly right.
The case where it really is clear is the co-defendant and the same offense, and right. That there's nothing in the language to limit A6 to...
Even without the language about disparity, we're still instructed to review for reasonableness. And if we were to conclude, or if the district court were to announce these people are exactly the same, and just for the heck of it, I'm going to give one the death penalty and one probation, that would be unreasonable, wouldn't it, regardless of the language of the various factors to be taken into consideration?
Yes, and for the district court to make findings and for findings to be clear on the record that our client's assistance was far greater than anyone else's, because he assisted in bringing in the gang leader.
Now you may want
okay, to... on the remedy issue for this, suppose you're...
I understand. I appreciate it, Your Honor.
I don't want
yes.
I don't know where we are, but on the remedy for a disparity between co-defendants, why isn't the proper remedy to increase the sentence for the other co-defendant rather than decrease the sentence?
The other co-defendant is not before the court, and the government is not before the court, and it is interesting here that
but if you've got this argument before a district judge in time...
Yes. It's interesting.
Theoretically, you have to get this argument before a district judge before the judge sentences
yes.
either of the two.
That's correct. Yes. And here, it's interesting that the co-defendant did not apparently receive an enhancement for the role in the offense, and he did apparently supervise more than four individuals. And so I don't know why that was and why the district court didn't consider that.
Well, that was the deal with the government. I realize that didn't
the court. The court was not limited by the deal and right, should have applied right. the guidelines, and I don't... We don't
Is there any explanation why these sentencings are separate transactions?
I think that usually when there are co-defendants, sentencings happen separately, in any event, individually. I think that that's typically the way courts do it, because they're individual proceedings, because the pre-sentence reports are not typically distributed to other co-defendants.
No.
And
no.
So we do not have the co-defendant's pre-sentence report, for example. Thank you. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, Ms. Dyer. And thank you, Ms. Miller. Sorry.
And
this is his, right?
Yes. But I guess he took the mail.
Okay.
No, he said to. He said something he doesn't because he gave me very specific instructions about it.
Really?
Usually just.
He said to put it back with the mail right in the front.
Okay.
Yeah, all of
would do the notebooks.
Next to the cases that they're...
Yeah,
he
said it.
He must have had some sort of experience. I think he's going to want those, too.
Yeah, I just made them.
This one's so Tara.
And does he already have Joseph?
Joseph. I only see two notebooks.
So do you take ABA? There's a whole case missing right here.
No, we got it right here. Okay. I got it right here. Okay. Yeah, keys.
Okay, so I think we have it.
Yeah, I guess he took all that. He was like,
he takes them in all.
No, but he very specifically was like, you need to line it up this way. Because I guess it's that he has some experience with it.
I think he knew what I meant for us for a while. Like, Redwell's notebooks, but he always wanted to know.
Maybe you could dance, you didn't, or something. Oh, okay. I'm going to go with Fortune the Runner's alarm on the door.
Pardon? If he's just knocking on the door, then he can go.